Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Our speaker tonight is Brenda. I think most of you know Brenda. She's been around for more than 30 years, an ordained priest, a physician who practices at Stanford in pain management, a mother, a wife, a grandmother, and our speaker for tonight. Do you have a title, Brenda?
Yes, Falling In.
Falling In.
So good evening, everybody, dear friends, blessed teacher, my teacher. Many of my stories these days have to do with my little grandchild, William, who continues to be a source of inspiration. I like to say that basically I have a front seat at the School of Human Development. Watching it as a grandparent is very different than watching someone grow up as a parent, where you have so many concerns and worries and everything. Are you doing it right? What's going on? And as a grandparent, you're just so relaxed. You're just okay. And you notice a lot more. So, I noticed that, when as a baby, we don't know anything how to care for ourselves, right? We don't even know what that means. All we know is, sometimes we feel like crying. And sometimes we don't feel like crying. And so we have, when we're very young, we have sort of two states, maybe three states: cry, no cry, maybe asleep or suckling. And so there are very, very few options there in our lives. And we don't know, after a few months, there's another state that happens that we can call smile. We see something, recognize something, a little smile. And we don't really know what's happening in that little baby's mind, right? We don't know what they're doing, but that's what we can see from the outside. Cry, we'll cry, fussy, smile. And then later, as we get a little older, we learn that when we cry, sometimes we're fed. And then we learn that that leads to no cry. And we learn to call that hunger. And that sometimes we learn that when we go from no cry to cry, that sometimes people put us in a bed and something happens and then we wake up and we feel better and we're told that we were tired and that we slept. And slowly we learn that food makes us full, that our parents can comfort us and make us feel safe, that sleep makes us feel rested. And time passes, and I'll fast forward. Later, we go to school, and we learn that, when we are able to spell a word correctly, we're told we're very smart. Or we do our math, and we're told that we're very strong, or in gymnastics, or gym, all kinds of things, we're told that we're doing well. And then later, we grow up some more, and then we maybe get a job, and we are given some money, and we're told that that is good. And then we get paychecks and paychecks. Hopefully, we get paychecks. Not all of us. Sometimes we struggle with that. Sometimes we might you know, yearn for the boss's approval for something. And that might be a symbol that we're happy. And then, or maybe a beloved partner might make us happy. And then at some point, as often happens, maybe a disappointment, or maybe actually we get what we wanted. We get exactly what we want. Sometimes just with time, maybe illness, that link weakens. Something happens. At first, we grip harder. Like, I'm not holding on tight enough. So we grip harder. Maybe we try to go to something else. Maybe I'm in the wrong, doing the wrong thing. I need to try something different. So we look for something else. And even that gives way. You might try a few times. And then we might feel a hollowness falling in, an inability to satisfy craving that is inside. We can't seem to figure out what it is outside that was satisfying us before. And then at that point, we may eventually tire of the chase and return home to rest. And there, surprisingly, we find that we have everything we need. We have ourselves, we have our breath, and we find that sometimes we cry and sometimes no cry, and perhaps smile. So I invite you, even as you're listening right now to this talk, to discover for yourself, where are you right now in that cycle? And we often are taught by different traditions to practice gratefulness. Yeah. Always had a hard time with that for some reason. Just like grateful for something, grateful for nothing. I don't know, what am I supposed to be grateful for? And how am I supposed to be grateful? Like, I wasn't really quite knew what to do with that. So more recently, I started thinking of it as the state of enough. That you have enough. Is this place of you have everything you need. Even if there's things that you may want, it doesn't mean that you don't want anything or you're not working towards something. It's more a sense of acceptance of things as they are right now, that they don't have to be different right now. That we don't need something else to be a certain way, to be content. And a very strange thing happens that we notice when that actually happens, when we fall into that place, we notice an incredible abundance all around us that was there all along. The whole world seems strangely alive, an amazing universe all around us. We are also there, but something has changed. We are no longer the frame of reference for everything around. We are free. And it may be for just a minute or a little longer. It doesn't matter. Our story, what we tell other people about ourselves, is often a linear path. Usually the main theme on the agenda, my list of things to do. I'm very good at that. Some of us are very good at that, running our lists. And that story is kind of cut a little bit, ever so briefly. When we are in this different frame of reference. So I invite you to consider that frame of reference, not as something that we get to somehow with our efforts, but as something that is, in a sense, coexisting all the time with us right now, that is a very fundamental part of us, almost as if our bodies or psyches or consciousness is kind of like a chord, an arpeggio of sorts, you know, that we have sort of, or, you know, a concert, that there's a storyline, you know, playing in the above the violins. And then there's the, you know, maybe the oboes are sort of playing in between, and sort of these different emotional tones or conscious or unconscious themes that are playing through the background of our minds, you know. And then there's a bass. And the bass is always there. It's always sort of keeping things, our heartbeat, our breath, sort of the cadence of our lives that's, it's always continuing and sustaining us. And it's, nature is peace. Doesn't need anything. Doesn't want anything. So I invite you to practice seeing it and feeling it all at the same time. Enjoying the orchestra that is our lives. Thank you. Any questions or comments? Diane?
I like your image of the orchestra. But sometimes the orchestra is such a cacophony of sounds, right? And when we sit, sometimes it takes a while for that to settle. And I think practicing acceptance and gratitude are really key. And I see it a little bit differently, more differently than you, in the sense that maybe I see people around me who are becoming physically frail or have illness, or sometimes I complain about my own physical aches or pains, or I get caught up in being a person doing instead of being. And I think if I didn't have our practice to bring me back to that place of acceptance and gratitude and focusing on the simple what is, I'd really have that crazy stuff going on in my head all the time. So I do like that image that you described. If we can only go back to being simple little children again, huh? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. You know, if I could say one more thing, Diane, to what you just said, I thought it was very, very nice. Is, you know, I think as we're falling in, we tend to panic a little bit, and we're afraid of cry no cry. We don't know what it means. We think it must be something wrong with us. And so then we fight, and then we struggle to cling to something that will keep us from cry no cry. but it's a very natural state of our being. And it's okay.
Yeah, well, it's the story that you talked about too. We all have our storyline that we follow, and like a script, and we want to be in that story the way we've written it, right? But life isn't like that, so accepting what is and being with it is really important.
Thank you. Peter?
What is gratitude?
Gratitude is when you're looking through the eyes of what you have rather than what you want. Or what you are. Marlena.
Thank you for your talk. Nice to see you.
Thank you. Nice to see you too.
And everyone. I heard once that if you're depressed, a good thing to do would be to every night before you go to bed, you write down 5 things that you're grateful for. And a gratitude list. I once had a health emergency in Italy with my niece, and we were bumped off the student tour and I was in hospital, but we were in the lobby before we got accepted anyway. So what I started to do is write a gratitude list, and we just go back to the gratitude list, you know. Oh, we have our luggage. We have coins to be able to buy food in the machines. There are nice people around us. So on and on and on. And just every time it got a little shaky, we'd go back to our gratitude list. And it was really helpful. I mean, it helped us, you know, with our anxiety and with just our mental state and not complaining.
Yeah. It'd be very helpful.
Yeah.
You know, there's some movies about happiness that were made, and I can't remember who it was, maybe Wayne Dyer or somebody, I can't remember who it was, Netflix, I think they were, but they interviewed many people and, you know, how happy are you and so forth. And they would say, why are you happy? You know, and what are you happy about? And the one I remember was a family who lived in a shanty town somewhere in India. And it was just a tent. They didn't quite have a house. There's just a tent. And then the gentleman was saying, and he looked the part. They were filming as well as they were interviewing, and said, you know, are you happy? And he looks at the camera. He says, are you kidding me? Of course I'm happy. Then the interviewer says, why are you happy? He says, you know, when I come home in the afternoon and I see my daughter's face, and she had a little girl, you know, a few years old, and she smiles at me and says, hi, daddy, I am the happiest man in the world. And he says, sometimes, you know, we don't have enough rice, but I can go down 2 tents over there and, you know, my friend will give me some rice, but I have everything I need. I am the happiest man in the world. And, you know, I just remember that, you know, when I have a rough day, I'm like,
Winston Churchill, I was asked the same question, are you happy? And he answered, do you think I'm an idiot?
Yeah, that's.
I like your better.
Thank you, Brenda.
Thank you, Philip.
I like the feeling of being a grandchild around those vibes.
Yeah, some other people feel like it too.
There's something unsurprisingly challenging about falling in to a place where you're seeing things from the eyes of what you have. And I find myself saying, wait, this is just, life is supposed to be suffering in our tradition, Buddhist tradition, and it's not supposed to be something that's that you just fall into. So that's a challenging perspective for me. I love that. Want to keep that. In a way, it's so much harder than struggling. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Yes, Philip.
If there's not a question right this moment, I wanted to ask, how would you, when William is at 50 or 60 years old, the age of where it's time for him to be falling in, or maybe 70 or 80, what would you say to him to offer
offer some helpful comment or something?
I think the vibes that you have for him are wonderful. Yeah. Maybe enough without teaching, but I'm curious.
What would I say to 60 or 70-year-old William?
Yes, what teaching would you?
Interesting. If I were around, which I won't be, probably, I would remind him of when he was young, of when life was so carefree and spontaneous, and he just, he grabs a little flower and holds it in his hand and looks at it and pulls it apart. And I say, come on, just take one. He's like, okay, I'll take one. No, okay, I'll just take one. And then takes another one. And, just little things that we all experienced when we were young and free. Most of us, maybe some of us had very, very difficult childhoods. Maybe I don't remember happy times, but most of us remember some times when we had that sort of carefree feeling, when we were just okay, with what was going on or who we were, or we didn't understand too much, but okay. I think that's what I would try to remind him of. Umar.
So 10 years ago, when I was working at the Stanford bookstore, my manager got me a little bit of help, temporary help, and there was this Indian, young Indian man who came and worked with me. And so Fridays I used to do the barbecue for the bookstore on their patio and do, you know, hot dogs and chicken and tofu dogs and whatever people wanted. And so, and it was really interesting. And so we would call him and out, and one day I called him out and said, I made a plate for you. You've been working, so come and sit down and eat. And he said, I said to him, is this good? And he said, oh man, you have no idea how good this is. This is amazing. And I said, what about the work that you're doing? And he was just like, he was shelving books and packing boxes, and he was just enthusiastic. Like he was over the moon for doing this work. And so I said, so what happened? What's your history? So I was like, 3 years ago, I was 17 and I started doing drugs in San Jose. Yeah. So his mother got disgusted with him and sent him to Wyoming. And the first job that, sorry, not Wyoming, Idaho. And first job that he got was they gave him a jackhammer and told him, see that porta potty? You're going to tip it over, and the poop that's underneath that, you're going to jackhammer that. Hmm. So that's the first job that he got, and he did that for 3 months. That, you know, till the winter was gone. Hmm. And then from there he went to India, and India he did nothing else but 16 hours. First he went to the village. And the job that he got in the village was, so the way that they husk rice is there's a half basket that's shaken like this, and the seeds, rice seeds are thrown up in the air, and it separates the husk when you do this sort of a motion. So he had to do that for 16 hours. Then from there, he went to Delhi. And he spent 16 hours a day doing data entry work. So he said, compared to all those jobs that I have, man, this is wonderful. This is the most beautiful experience, life experience that I've had. And, you know, this is amazing. And you guys are giving me barbecue on the weekend. I can't believe this. This is like, you know, it was just like he had a smile from here to here, you know, just like. And now I saw his mother a few years back. I said, how's he doing? And she said, oh, he's amazing now. He went to San Jose State and he got a degree in environmental engineering. He's working for a nonprofit, and he's become a very happy person. So, you know, here he was, and it was just like his father had passed away, and so he had no guidance. So, mother took some really, drastic measures and give him a life lesson that you don't need very much to be happy. And that's what, so he's just become a very happy person now. Even people who have worked with him said, oh, he is one of the most happiest people that you'll ever meet in the world. I was like, wow, you know, sometimes that's what it takes to change people.
Yeah. And, you know, it really affects everyone around him too. Like you were affected by seeing him, right? Be so happy.
Yeah, it was just like, it was just oozing out of him.
Yeah.
You know, this joy working. I'm like, wow. I kept on thinking, man, I can't even reach that level of happiness that you're at. This is amazing.
And right.
You know, things like that. But he never touched drugs again, and you know, he didn't want to. It just completely changed his life. Yeah.
It's awesome. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for sharing
that. Yeah.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Hi, Sage.
Hi there. Thank you so much for your talk. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Perfect. So I have a question that I hope is both coherent and not too much of a bummer, but here it goes. I'm wondering about, you know, like everybody brings their whole self to the practice. And part of that means that there are those of us who have a tremendous amount of like pain and abuse that we bring with us to the practice, or like that experience. And I think the difficulty is not so much knowing how to do what you've described, or knowing that it's like available as a practice, but letting go of the fear that if you let down your guard for like just a second, like the pain and the abuse like comes back. Does that make sense? I was just wondering, like, I don't know, like, what do you do in that situation? Asking for a friend.
Right. I think this is just from my own experience with suffering, of various kinds. First of all, you do seek support, you know, where you make sure that you have some support. I think that's very important. Because these sorts of, you know, endeavors, often when you fall in initially, it can kind of increase the sensation of pain, right? Because you're kind of, your mind is sort of blocking it off a little bit, right? And it maybe sometimes we feel that also in sitting, like it can catch us quite by surprise, but we're like, we think we're calm, and then all of a sudden we might start crying. And sometimes we know why that's happening, and sometimes we don't. Sometimes it's just our nervous systems just have some kind of emotional pain stored in there for whatever reason that we may have long forgotten, and we just cry, and that's okay. And I think so, first making sure you have support, that, you know, somebody is helping you with it, and then gently titrating. You don't have to do it all at once. Just kind of, you know, dip a foot in, you know, let it air out, and then another time dip a foot in again, and then, you know, titrate little bits and pieces, and let the pain come out. And then I think the other part is also, you know, what sometimes is called resourcing. So making sure that you, in addition to having people to support, like maybe a counselor or a good friend or partner, is also making sure that you are doing lots of practices that sustain you. That could be whatever that is. Like if you like, I don't know, meditation is a big one, right? Meditation really helps. And it helps even out the territory. It helps that sense of equanimity a little bit, so that whatever is seen, you can accept whatever is seen. Maybe painful, maybe not painful, that you can, it helps you to accept it a little more. And also, you know, but things like physically taking care of yourself, eating healthy food, making sure you're sleeping enough as you're doing this process. So really taking care of yourself. I mean, if you like music, listening to music, or hanging out with good friends, and so all those things that make us feel, you know, give us a sense of comfort and improve our well-being. So make sure you're doing plenty of those, even as you're doing the work, as it's called. and it takes time. Be patient with yourself. And I think sometimes we make it worse because we somehow feel like it shouldn't happen, or it should be done. It should be finished already. Wait, I thought I'd gone through that already. Why is this happening again? You know, so don't add suffering. Don't go for suffering squared. Try to keep the suffering just at the suffering level. Does that help?
Yes, thank you so much. And as a world's leading expert in metta suffering, I will try and not do that.
Okay. Philip?
I wanted to say that there are a few of us in the Zoom room who also attended the previous lecture at Everyday Zen on Genjo Koan. And I don't know about those others, but for me, the topic of your talk, somehow your your speaking has so much the feeling of Genjo Koan, especially that for me, especially for that notion of cry, being able to accept cry and no cry, in such an open, the kind of opening that suggests. And in terms of suffering, one of the things that was presented by Natalie, I don't know her last name, but she was 95 years old, a wonderful speaker, wonderful clarity. She mentioned a poem of Dogen's, which he wrote shortly before his death when he was going to Kyoto for treatment for something that I think was tuberculosis, something like that, where he was really sick. And this poem was written on the trip to Kyoto, on a pass, and I'm forgetting the name of the pass. And he speaks of his body being like a blade of grass, and being on top of the pass in the mist, feeling like wandering. I forget the exact phrase, but somehow the talk of suffering and really brought that up for me too, that poem of someone whose practice we is iconic for us to have that vulnerability and presence.
Thank you, Philip. Thank you. Craig, what does your t-shirt say?
I had a feeling somewhere you were wondering that. By myself, if I get back before I return, keep me here.
Seems very appropriate to today. Thank you, everybody.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.